Okay, we're starting the second part of what I call the Temple Project. It's where we start bringing together these concepts that are involved in the axioms that we've already gone through, and then the quick overview of the rules of interpretation. And particularly the Temple Project focuses on those aspects of the axioms and rules that talk about the background, the history, the culture, the geographical setting in which these documents were written. Just as we would expect someone living in Washington, D.C., who was writing about some situation there involving the local city, to just presume the readers have a certain knowledge of what's there, so he doesn't feel compelled to give us a detailed description of how Washington, D.C. is laid out, and about the Capitol building and the Smithsonian and all the monuments and the mall and all of those things. He'll just start writing. And for those who wouldn't know that, he would presume that they would have access to that knowledge if they needed it. And the same thing is true in the Bible. The original recipients of almost all of the documents in the Bible, if they didn't have intimate knowledge of this background and history and geography and so forth, they had at least a working knowledge of it or easy access to it. But as we've already discussed, we're now separated by a great barrier, set of barriers, not only linguistic but also cultural, historical, geographical, chronological. And now we're trying to bridge that gap. And that's what we want to do when we read the Scriptures and study them. And if you become involved in a ministry where it's you're teaching, you want to communicate that to your students, brothers and sisters in Christ, so they have that better knowledge as well. Because a part of interpretation is taking into account this to more fully grasp what the author's mindset was, situation was as he speaks. We saw last time how often it is mentioned in the Gospels that Jesus was up at the temple. I've put together some slides here that we'll sort of go through. In the process of that, we'll touch on many or maybe most of the things that are on your assignment that is to be turned in this time, so you can just follow along on your assignment. If you didn't get something on there yet, this would be the time to mark it. I'm not as interested in that you did it outside of class as I am that you got it before you turn it in, that you at least put pencil to paper and were able to identify what we're talking about here. This first slide that I'm presenting to you is an author's, an artist's conception of what the area around Jerusalem would have looked like in the time of Jesus, if someone could have gone up in a helicopter and drawn a sketch of what they were seeing below. As near as modern scholarship is able to ascertain, this is something of the layout of the city. So let me point out a few things to you as we're organized here. Straight up is not due north in this particular drawing. North is actually angled more up and to the right. You can see at the very top where it says north up there. And therefore south would be pointing this way. As we look at the city, we can see the city wall. Every city of any consequence from earliest Old Testament times, practically speaking, all the way down to almost modern times, had a wall that was for defense. In case of attack by an enemy, it provided some measure of protection for the occupants from those who were without. We have that wonderful story in the Old Testament during the days of King Hezekiah when Sennacherib, king of the Assyrians, has showed up with his forces and surrounded the city. And sends out his envoy to address the people on the wall and say, what makes you think that your God is going to be able to protect you from me and my army? No city and no king and no God has been able to stand against me until now. And the same is going to be the case now. And basically he just said God's a do-nothing, that your God is impotent, unable to protect you. And of course that's when he wakes up the next morning and finds about 185,000 of his best troops dead in their tents. And what he had left of an army, which probably wasn't a whole lot, he gathers together and they pack up what they can and they go home. And he never comes back again. Well, the very reason he had to demand they surrender is because he knew what a task it was going to be to try to tear down those walls or breach those walls to get into the city. And that was the typical approach on any city when it had walls, was to either starve them to death inside, because if you can't get in, they can't get out, or else finally just try to breach the walls in some way, break down, find a weakness in the walls and break through, or get over the walls, somehow get inside. We know that David, when he first conquered Jerusalem, back when it was a much smaller city than this, and at that time was called Salem, or perhaps Jebu Salem, because the people who lived inside the city at the time he conquered it or captured it were called the Jebusites. But even for the Jewish people to say Jebu Salem just didn't roll off the tongue, and so it gradually, that B sound got changed over to an R sound, and so Jerusalem or Jerusalem. But in order for him to capture the city, his men found a hidden tunnel or channel that allowed them to get in the city from beneath. And maybe in our next slide, where we have a little bit closer view of the city, we can point out probably where that spot was. But anyway, here's our city. We have some geographical features around it. First of all, you can see the temple area itself, the temple constructed on top of the highest point in the city. And off to the east of it is the Kidron Valley, which had the Kidron Brook running through it, though it's not clear whether water always ran there or whether it was sort of a seasonal thing as far as the water was concerned. But certainly there was the Kidron Valley, and several bridges had been built across the valley for the ease of travel. Here's one here that entered in through the Golden Gate, as it was called, on the east side of the city. There was another one that was down here at the southern end of the city, that you could come into the city from here and come up by the Pool of Siloam, which was at the lower end of the city. And this road here that ran out and down runs to Bethany. I did leave it on the map here. You can just faintly see it. But Bethany was southeast of Jerusalem, about 2 miles. We know that that's the place where Jesus often stayed with Lazarus and Martha and Mary in their home, used it as a base of operations sort of at times when he was near going up to Jerusalem. And so when they came from Bethany into Jerusalem, they'd come up this road and they would have this gradual incline, because from Bethany, Jerusalem's not visible. It's over on the other side of a ridge in terms of the rise of the land. So as they came up this ridge, and then suddenly when they're very close to the city, they topped the ridge, and there's a whole beautiful city right in front of them. And it's thought this is exactly where the triumphal entry, or the Palm Sunday entrance of Jesus on the week that begins, that ends in his death, takes place, as he tops this ridge here, which is the southern end of the Mount of Olives. He tops that, and there's the city. And as he's coming down with all these other pilgrims headed into Jerusalem for the Passover, people are lining the streets, cheering, shouting, singing, praying, waving palm fronds, and laying branches of trees and palm fronds down on the ground in front of them. The palm frond had a special significance for the people during that period of time, because about 180 years before, 200 years before, when the Jewish people had risen up against the Syrians, who controlled their nation at that time, and had driven out the Syrians and had taken control of their own nation again. This was under the Maccabees. During that period of time, whenever they had the great celebration after everybody was driven out and they could once again purify the temple and reestablish the priesthood and start living as an independent nation again, they had that great celebration in which the people came together with their palm fronds and all stood and sang and prayed. To them, the waving of the palm frond meant deliverance. It meant salvation. It meant freedom. And so here comes Jesus into the city, and because many of them believe He's the Messiah, but they're thinking of Messiah in terms of a political salvation, aren't they? Freedom from the Romans. And because they believe and hope Jesus is that, that's why they're waving those palm fronds. They've stripped the trees probably in the immediate area to get these branches from the palms to wave them. And so this immediately becomes an alert to the Jewish leadership that there may be trouble ahead, because the people all believe Jesus has come to deliver them from the Romans. It's no wonder then that the high priest and others go to Pilate and want to, let's make a deal to get rid of this guy, sort of thing. And when they're telling Pilate, he thinks he's a king, they could, and maybe did in the conversation with Pilate, point to this entrance into Jerusalem with the palm fronds and everything as evidence that the people were looking for a military, political revolution to take place. Anyway, that all takes place at the southern end of the city, and here's one of the entrances into the city. It was the main one, obviously, for people coming in from the south and southeast. And if you came down this road to Bethany and you kept going, eventually about 18 or 20 miles down there through the mountains and so forth is Jericho. We know that was a major route for pilgrims to come in, was to come in from over on the other side of the Jordan and up through Jericho, up through this rugged road where Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, end up in Bethany, and then through there and into the southern end of the city. This part of the city right along the eastern wall, this strip right along here, was often called the City of David. That was a part of the ancient city. That was the oldest part of it, going back to David and before. Gradually, of course, the city had grown to the west. And as it grew to the west, you've got more and more affluent people. Those who lived furthest to the west were the most affluent. They were also slightly higher up in the city in terms of elevation. The winds, the prevailing winds around Jerusalem blow most of the time from the west. That means when people have their cook fires going in their homes and so forth, and the smoke rises up from their homes, the wind's going to carry that smoke from the west to the east. So if you lived over on this side of town, you used to live sort of in the lower class part of town, and you had a lot of smog and pollution because the smoke from the houses to your west were always blowing over you. And that's why the rich liked to live on the west side of town. That was a nicer part. The high priest is thought to have, there's good evidence he had his palace over there. Yes, a palace. The high priest lived in a palace. Herod had his own palace here. Jesus ends up there during his trial at Herod's palace for a short period of time. There was, I don't have a pointer here, I guess I'll just wait till I get the closer up picture, but all sorts of other things. Just look at the southern end of the city. You have another valley that ran across the southern end of the city. In fact, the walls right here were quite steep down into this valley. In Old Testament times in particular, this was where the city dump was. It was called the Valley of Hinnom. At one time it had been a place where some altars and so forth had been set up to other gods like Molech or Baal, and where even human sacrifices had been made. And then after the return from Babylon, that whole area had been condemned and had been turned into the city dump as a way of saying, in an ultimate way, we desecrate these formerly sacred places to these false idols, these false gods, these idols. And from that Valley of Hinnom comes the word in the New Testament, Gehinnom or Gehenna, which is translated most of the time in our English translations by the word hell. When Jesus talks about it's better for a man to enter into life maimed, we saw that scripture a while back, with something missing, than it is with two good hands or two good eyes to go into Gehenna. There are records of times in the Old Testament, at least, at the end of the Old Testament period of time, when someone was a criminal or something, they would actually take his body after he had been stoned to death and throw it over the wall, the southern wall of the city, down into the Valley of Hinnom, into the dump. And that image, even though we don't know how often it actually happened in reality, was enough for Jesus to use as symbolic of what happens to someone in God's presence whenever they're eternally condemned. They're cast into the eternal fire. And in their city dump, the fire's burned all the time to do some purifying of what is thrown in there, and of course to burn up that which is burnable. And that allows, just like in modern city dumps, that allows them to put more refuse in there, because once the fire has done its job, it takes up a lot less space. And you can put more in on top. But that was the Valley of Hinnom. Valley of Hinnom, Kidron Valley and Brook, Mount of Olives, and this whole ridge line along here. The Mount of Olives at its peak was a little higher than the temple itself. And so when we saw that scripture last time where it says Jesus left the temple and went across and up on the Mount of Olives, and then it says he was across from the temple. That's what it means. He was across the valley from it, and they could look right over into the temple. Yes?
You know, you bring up an interesting point. You were talking about the downside of people would throw things just over the wall. It reminds me of the different scriptures where it talks about being cast out of the city of heaven and you know, mm-hmm. just kind of being cast out. And I always had this picture of being cast out the front gate. I'm like, oh, I'm sad because I'm not inside. This gives a different meaning to that altogether. Being cast out and thrown into the dump, I mean, mm-hmm. that's like an entirely different. It's not like you're just outside with your baggage. Where do I go now? You know, it's a lot more severe.
Yeah.
If that's the concept that they had of it, being cast out over that uh-huh. nasty south wall.
Right, or even in some of the parables of Jesus, or one in particular I think of where he talked about the one of the servants that hadn't done what he's supposed to, and I think had showed up without a wedding robe on and so forth,
right.
and said concerning him, cast him into outer darkness. Certainly that, in one way, that seemed inconsistent with the fires burning always, but in the other, there's no lights down there, nobody lives down there, and so you cast him in the outer darkness, you just cast him over the wall. At least figuratively speaking. Now we get a little bit closer up picture of this, and this starts making things a little easier to see. Down at the bottom, the Pool of Siloam, we have a healing take place there, don't we? By Jesus. If you see it down there, that area is under excavation right now by archaeologists. There's no question about where the Pool of Siloam is, because it's being excavated and not really restored, but in part made cleared away so people can see it. And up above the temple, up in the north, you can see this other complex up here. That's another pool called the Pool of Bethesda in the Scriptures. Jesus healed somebody up there as well. Yes?
Were any of these pools natural pools, or were they actually, like, they bring in water?
Okay. The Pool of Bethesda is a natural pool. In David's time, the city didn't extend that far north. The city stopped right about here. And downward was just the city then. And so that pool, our natural spring, was way outside the city to the north. So in time of crisis, war, and so forth, that water wouldn't be available to them since it would be outside the city. For a long time, critical scholars doubted the existence of Bethesda because the Bible said it was there, and they hadn't found it yet. It's now been found. It is also in the process of being excavated by the archaeologists. One of the difficulties in finding it turned out to be that it's some 25 feet below the level of the land and material around it today. Then it was on the same plane with everything else, but over all the centuries of Jerusalem being rebuilt, destroyed, wars, crusades, all of those things, there just has been this buildup of debris and so forth that new parts of the city have been built on top of. But they've now discovered it down there, and it's in the process of being excavated as well. And it truly is as beautiful as what few things we have in the Scripture that says about it indicated it was. Yes?
Another question, too. Where's the cisterns that David went into to get into the original?
Okay. The problem David had in the Old Testament, which was partly solved in the New Testament with several things, water is a critical thing in a city in ancient times. You needed not only good walls to protect you, but you somehow needed to have water inside of those walls in case your enemy surrounded you. Otherwise, you know, you might can ration out the food and last a long time. But if there's not water, you're not going to last very long. You know, we human beings tend to start dehydrating pretty rapidly after about 3 days without water. But we can go much longer, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks without significant amounts of food before it becomes a real problem. And so in Old Testament times, one of the things about the Jebusalem was right here, just outside the wall, and it's almost vertically straight down, was a spring called the Gihon Spring. Now, you had to... it looked like normally it'd have to somehow get outside the city wall and go down and draw the water. When they call it a spring, it's actually a well. I mean, it's a hole, and down at the bottom of the hole, the spring is feeding up. And what the ancient peoples of Jebusalem had done is inside the city walls, they had tunneled downward. They had made a shaft downward and then angled it to the right that ran out underground to the Gihon Spring. And so, don't know exactly how they got down the vertical part of the shaft, whether they let people down by ropes or whether they had rope ladders or spiral staircases, probably something that was easily removed. But anyway, they could get to their water, and they had apparently built a little sort of retaining wall that hid that from their enemies. So they could get to the water from the inside, and the enemy wouldn't necessarily know it was there, even though it wasn't inside the city wall. David's men came in by way of the spring, went up that shaft, climbed up that vertical shaft, and got into the city that way, through the shaft that gave the ancient inhabitants of Jebusalem access to the water, by going through the shaft here. In the days of King Hezekiah, when Hezekiah knew that he needed to do something as his city was growing and God was blessing him and them during that period of time, he needed to do something to secure water for his city. And so he had two things done. One, he had a reservoir built down here that we now in New Testament times call the Pool of Siloam. He actually had this constructed. And then he had two sets of workers go to work digging a tunnel. And they dug a tunnel from the Gihon Spring underground and downhill all the way from there when it opened up down here in the Gihon in the Pool of Siloam. That's recorded in the Old Testament. It's also recorded in other forms of Jewish history. The workers dug from both ends, sometimes being 30, 40, 50, 60 feet below ground. And yet when the workers were close, each of them could hear the worker on the other side of the stone that still separated, hear them chipping away. And when they broke through, they were off by like 2 inches from each other. I mean, you know, that tunnel still exists today. At times, they allow tourists to actually go through the tunnel. At other times, because of security and so forth, it's closed to the public. But when you go through that tunnel, at the, I think at each end of the tunnel, there is an inscription on the wall inside the tunnel from the days of Hezekiah, identifying what the tunnel is. And in the middle, where they joined up, there's an inscription on the wall that says, on this day, workers from both ends met up and the tunnel was completed. And right there where they meet, you can see the tunnel is a slight offset, you know, between the walls on the side. They just missed by that much. It was an incredible engineering feat by people in, you know, 700 BC to be able to do something like this. And some ancient records from that time indicate that it was done, of course, partly because they had good surveyors who up on the surface could figure exactly what angle to go at and so forth. But also they had men up on top, because this is almost solid rock all down through here they're cutting through, not soiled, but rock. Up on the surface, they would be up on top with pick hammers hitting the rock, and the men down below, 30, 40, 50 feet down, could hear which way they were supposed to go by where the sound was coming up above them. I mean, you know, it just boggles my mind to think of what all must have been involved to make this happen. But they built this, and because it is downhill, water immediately was flowing. In fact, probably the men working from the north were working in water from their knees to their waist most of the time they're digging. There had to be a time maybe when they dammed it up to do part of it, but whenever they broke through, immediately the water rushes through all the way down and fills up the pool down here. Then Hezekiah has his workers come back and completely seal up the outside entrance with stone and rock and so forth. So after just a few years, it just looked like the rest of the surface of the rock there. And no one out here would even know they could break through the wall right there and get to the city's water supply. Because now the city's water supply was down here. And that still existed in Jesus' time.
So the Kishon is actually a higher elevation than the pool of...
Yes, this is downhill. I forget what the drop is. You'd have to, if you read in your Bible dictionary, look up Gihon Spring or Hezekiah's Tunnel and read about that. They'll tell us what the drop in elevation is between them.
Where's this water coming from? What's the body water that supplies water to all those other things?
That's an interesting question. The question is, where does the water come that's feeding this spring and the one up there? No one knows exactly. Some underground source that is perpetual. That is, it never goes dry. There's no record of from ancient history or modern history where this has ever been dry. Now, because the Pool of Bethesda has been sealed over for hundreds, maybe over 1,000 years, we can't quite know for sure if it's perpetual or not, though we think it is. Remember, that's the pool that the man who was there lame or crippled said, there's no one to help me into the water when the water is stirred. And scholars believe that means there were times when bubbles or an greatly increased flow of water would take place, and it would cause the water to boil up almost and be stirred up either from...
So is that a hot spring?
It was a warm spring, yes. And that's not the case of the Siloam Pool, which again makes us think they're probably not coming from the same source. By Jesus' time, because the city has grown so greatly, it's not only highly inconvenient for everybody to come all the way down here for their drinking water, but it also isn't sufficient anymore. And so before New Testament times, under King Herod, a aqueduct was built. I don't know if it's on the map or not. It came in somewhere right up in here. It came from even further over to the west and north from the mountains and drew water in and brought water into the city by means of this aqueduct. You know, that was the thing the Romans were famous for all over the Roman Empire, or the remains still of their aqueducts, those long open-topped channels for bringing water in, like a canal, only it was above ground most of the way. And that's how water mostly came into the city in Jesus' time, but the Pool of Siloam and the Pool of Bethesda were very much apart. You can see up at the top one of the speculated areas they think might have been the place of the crucifixion. Another one that is often proposed is up here just north of the city of Bethesda. I mean, not the city of Bethesda, but the Pool of Bethesda. And still a third one is up to the straight up off the top of the map as we have it here. They also have proposed that as a place. They truly just don't know where Calvary was, in spite of the fact that there's now a church building built on top of where one ancient tradition placed Calvary as being. But there's no solid evidence one way or the other where it was. It was somewhere outside the city. You know, it says over in Hebrews 13 that he had to be taken outside the walls to die. In the Old Testament, when the sacrifice was made for sins, the scapegoat was taken outside the city. And also part of even the sacrifice for sin was taken outside the city and disposed of. Anita?
I have a question. When Nebuchadnezzar came in and destroyed the whole city, mm-hmm. did they have to rebuild the entire wall?
Yes. Now, realize that when Nebuchadnezzar comes in around 587 and destroys us, the city wasn't nearly as large as it is in this drawing here. This is a New Testament version of the city. The city in the time of the last kings, Josiah, all the way down to the last one, the city started down here, came up along this wall, and probably right about here came across, that would be the northern wall of the city in 587 B.C., and then down and across, and probably somewhere right about here came back down. So it was a smaller city. But yes, Nebuchadnezzar had all of these walls knocked completely down. And so when they returned from captivity in the book of Ezra and so forth, and then Nehemiah in particular, the first concern of Nehemiah in coming to the city was what? Getting the walls rebuilt. There were probably portions of the walls standing, but nothing that would have even stopped a goat from walking through them, you know. Just huge gaping holes that had been knocked in there, and that now they had been left desolate in that fashion for 50, 60, 70 years. But Nebuchadnezzar organizes the men, and they, in a very short period of time, how many days was it? Somebody remember how many days that was? 20-something, wasn't it? That they rebuilt the wall. In Nehemiah. Ever how many days it was a fairly short period of time. They actually got some kind of walls up there. And all the time, of course, their enemies are criticizing them and making fun of them. And of course, their enemies didn't want them to rebuild the walls, because as long as the walls were down, it gave even their enemies, their neighbors, and surrounding small nations, made Jerusalem a very vulnerable target. So that wall needed to be rebuilt. But, you know, here's something of the the view of the city in Jesus' time, if we could somehow get up above the city and look down upon it. And yet, when we read our New Testament, very little of all of this is even mentioned. It was just known to those folks. What we want to do is, as we read about this and study about it, start having a clear picture in our mind what it was looking like, so when we talk about it with others, and over the years we come to know it better, to those who hear us teach, it will sound to them like we've seen it, we've been there. You know what it's like when someone is telling you about a place they've been? They go to Washington Monument and go there, or they go to Mount Rushmore and are trying to describe what it's like. We've all seen the pictures. How many of us actually gone there? Do the pictures do it justice? Don't think so. But we want to be that way with our understanding of these things that we can know more about, like the city of Jerusalem and the temple in Jesus' time. I had an instructor when I was in Bible college named Homer Haley, and one of the recurring things I've heard over the years, I heard it while I was there, and I've heard it during all the years since by others who heard him teach, they would say about him that he talked about the prophets like he knew them personally. He had studied the Old Testament, particularly the prophets, so much, and had studied the background and the history and the culture so much, that when he talked about them, it sounded like, to his hearers at least, like he had been there. Because he communicated well what he had learned. Well, let's zoom in a little bit closer here and look at the city. This is another artist's conception, just from another angle, but maybe it gives us a little bit of a clearer idea. Now, this one has a few things in it. The other one did not. There are matters of speculation. There's no speculation about whether these things existed in Jesus' time in the city. The speculation is about exactly where were they. Here, for example, is a theater. There was actually a theater of the Greek style, like you would find in Ephesus or Corinth, in the city. There was also a stadium of the Ben-Hur horse racing variety in the city, or around the city. But the truth of the matter is, scholars have absolutely no idea where they were. They just know they were there. I've seen other artist conceptions that have them outside of the city. And there's some reasons for believing they might have been outside the city, because the Jews would have really found both of those things very offensive inside their city, because they represented Greek and Roman culture, not Jewish culture. Yes?
But at the same time, the Jews were very submissive to those cultures. Even to the point, that's why they had to take care of Jesus, because...
That's right.
But that one man died in all of us.
Right.
You know, the Roman Empire coming down and bringing their wrath on them for trying, you know, if they were to hear that they were to have this king of their own, you know.
Yes, and so they really wouldn't have had much choice in the matter. But we do know that the Romans were somewhat sensitive, at least, to trying not to be overly repulsive to the Jews. And so they were somewhat accommodating. The remains of neither of these structures, wherever they were in the city, have been found. No remains at all. On the other hand, here where Herod's temple is, we know exactly where it is because the remains exist today. And they've been excavated, and they are available for seeing if you go over there and take a tour of the city. Just a lot of things to say about that. The biggest problem with excavating an archaeological site like this is the fact there's still a living, vibrant city built on top of it. And all sorts of debris between what was there, most cases in New Testament times, and what is there today. But I just found that an interesting artist reconstruction of that. Now, when we turn to the temple itself, I ask you on your handout about try to find if you could in your Bible dictionary or Bible background books anything about the building of the temple itself and so forth. This is the temple as it had been expanded and rebuilt by Herod. And again, this is just an artist's conception. I know of one major thing missing in this artist's drawing, and that is somewhere right about here, and it should run all the way around the temple, should be a wall about 4.5 feet tall. And it was the wall that separated this area outside of the wall that was called the Court of the Gentiles from what was inside of that wall where only Jewish people could go. This was the wall of separation. You hear Paul in Ephesians chapter 2 talking about when Christ gave His body on the cross, He broke down the middle wall of partition that separated Jew and Gentile. He's using the imagery of their own temple in which they literally had a wall that separated the Jews on the inside from the Gentiles on the outside. It was God's plan from the days of Solomon, even going back to the tabernacle as far as that's concerned, that Gentiles should be able to draw near to God. They just could not get as near as the Jews could. And so that wall was there to let them come close, but no closer. So then in Acts, when the riot breaks out and they drag Paul out of the temple because someone said he brought a Greek into the temple, they were not talking about he brought him into this area out here. They're saying he brought him into this area up here, which was not allowed. In this wall that was built around this partition, like I say, about 4.5 feet tall, there were numerous openings in it for people to pass through. They had gatekeepers at each one. And that man's job was to certify whether you were Jewish or Gentile. If you were Gentile, his job was to stop you. And on the wall right next to that entrance, at each one of those entrances all the way around that allowed you through that wall, was a carved right into the stone was a message that said, any Gentile passing beyond this point is subject to instant death.
Subject.
And that may all sound highly romantic and idealized and so forth, except for the fact they have now found three of those carvings. Three of those carvings have been found by archaeologists that are the remains of that wall of partition. Yes, Cody.
It looks like stairs going down.
Okay. As we look at this whole structure, several interesting things about it. Here's the Golden Gate. They believe here. You sometimes see this entrance even today in pictures from the east side of the Temple Mount and so forth. What you need to realize is this entrance here is about 35 feet underground, and so the picture you're seeing today is of a, as over time as this filled in here, they just kept raising it higher and higher, and then finally, sometime during the days of the late Crusades, it was actually walled up. I don't remember whether it was the Christians or the Muslims that walled it up to make it more secure so the enemy couldn't come in through there. But today you just see the arches, but then you see them walled in from the Golden Gate. You see this whole big structure here. You have these various entrances into it. There was one entrance from the east. There was a bridge across the Kidron Valley that made it possible for people to come across from the Mount of Olives. They could come up from the road from Bethany. That road split way down here, the south of the city, and part of it wound up along the Kidron Valley, and so you could come in that way. A road came from the northeast that came down and joined in with it and also allowed you in. So there's one entrance on the east. There was one entrance on the north. There's no indication from history they ever actually even used that entrance. There were two entrances on the south. They're underground as far as this surface up here is concerned. This surface up here is, I'm guessing, maybe 20, 25 feet higher than this surface right here is. But you have these two entrances. You go in, and there's underground stairs that go up and open up here. It's just like in a stadium. You know, you come in down low, and you go underneath the stadium, and here's a stairwell, and you climb up, and suddenly there you are up on the level where everything's happening. Parts of this exist today. It's under excavation by the archaeologists right now. I didn't bring pictures of it, but if you do the Google search on the internet or something, this southern staircases for the temple have been uncovered today. Again, they had to dig down to get to them. But you got this entrance. There was a this little corner entrance here was, even though I said there's only one entrance on the east, so for some reason they didn't count this as an entrance, even though it was. But you could come in and go up through this rather ornate staircase here. There was another one like that around on this side. There were four gates on the west side, right up about here. If you could look down on the down this west side is what is today the Wailing Wall. That's where the Wailing Wall is today. Yes?
And the soldiers would stand on top of that. How did the soldiers get?
Okay. In the story in Acts, the soldiers see the riot beginning down in the temple complex. They are Roman soldiers. They are stationed up there in that, see that building at the very top? That's the Antonia Fortress up there.
The one on the back side?
Yeah, the one on the northwest corner up there. I can't jump high enough to touch it. I'd look silly if I tried. But that's the Antonia Fortress, and the Romans had forced the Jews to allow them to build that fortress up there and build a stairway from that fortress down over that. This area around here, all the way around, is called the porches or porticos or stoas. Those are all different words for the same thing. Stoa, portico, porch, all mean the same thing. These covered over walkways, or not walkways, not right, because you didn't walk on top of them, you walked under them. They were shaded, covered areas. But they cut a hole through the stoa up there and built their stairway down from the Antonia Fortress down into the court of the Gentiles up there, so the soldiers quickly could be deployed from the fortress down into the temple in case of a riot or problems. Because it had taken away from the Jews the right to do some things, and the Romans then had to step in and do it. Yes?
I read something also that said that that's where they stored, the Romans stored the robes of the high priest, because...
Right, even to...
They took away his authority to give it to him only at certain times, yeah, to limit his power.
Yeah, he could only be high priest when they granted him the privilege of coming up and checking out his own robe from the fort so he could wear it to carry out his high priestly duties. And, you know, that was just part of the Roman way. And that's what finally the Jews had agreed to, at least the high priest and his family had, so he could stay in power. No wonder the Jews found a lot of these things offensive. You can just imagine. That would be sort of like, you know, every time the President of the United States wants to do something as President of the United States, he has to go contact the President of Russia and get permission to get the keys to Air Force One. Or he has to go get permission from the president of Russia to get out the presidential seal and put it on the front of his stand before he can make a speech. That's somewhat the equivalent of what the Romans had done to the Jews. It made the power of the high priest be subject to the whim of the Romans. And that was not considered a very pleasant thing for the Jews.
It brings up a good point too, and really exemplifies how the Jews, you know, they were fakishly their own people, but they didn't feel it, you know. I'm sure they couldn't have. Another question too would be, if the Romans, if there's a riot, you know, they have the area of the Gentiles, but what if there's a riot, not the Gentiles? If the Romans are allowed to go to that area, I assume, right? I mean, if they can tell the high priest, well, you can't wear your robe unless we say so, and I'm sure they can go into even the, any part of that that they need to.
Right. Cody is bringing up the point that in an emergency, the Roman soldiers would cross through that partition and into the court that was only for the Jews. And even had come, there's one occasion shortly after Pontius Pilate became governor, and by the way, his quarters where he lived was up in the Antonia Fortress. That's where he was stayed when he was in town. Most of the time he liked to stay up in Caesarea away from the Jews and so forth. But when he came to Jerusalem, he always stayed in the Antonia Fortress. There was a situation almost immediately after he first got there when he demanded that the Jews do something and they refused to do it. And the high priest and the Sanhedrin and so forth had actually gathered in the court of women. This area here was called the court of the women because that's as far as women could go. They could go no further than that into the temple complex. And they were gathered there for some purpose. And he actually came with his soldiers out of the fortress, came into the court of the women, soldiers with their swords drawn. He threatened them with death if they didn't do what he told them to do. And so from the high priest to every member of the Sanhedrin, they all got down on their knees and threw back their prayer shawls and bent their heads and said, "Have at it." And he backed down. He didn't get off to a very good start with them, in which he threatened to kill them all, their leadership and everything, if they didn't do something he said. And they said, "Kill us." Because at that point, you see, he was on their territory, and they would rather die than submit to him under those circumstances.
And that points out, too, a little bit of, you see this struggle, this curious struggle going on with Christ, where he himself doesn't want to do anything to Christ.
Right.
But he's like, well, these people don't listen to me, you know. So how do I'll just beat Christ, maybe that'll pass
on. Anita.
I was surprised that the Muslims would allow very much excavation to go on.
Okay. That's a very good observation. In fact, you're commenting how very little, you wouldn't think the Muslims would allow them to do excavating. Anything that's up on top of this platform, as they call it, see, these stoas or porches no longer exist. They've all been torn down. They were torn down by the Romans. The temple area up there no longer exists. The Romans completely tore that down and built a temple to Jupiter on top of it after AD 70. Now the Muslims control all of this, and up there where the temple proper is where they have the Dome of the Rock. And I believe right down in this area here is where their mosque is. And they do not allow any excavation, any research and so forth, even by their own experts in that area. But this area off of the platform, they've allowed. And this area down in here, they have allowed. And over on the west side where the Wailing Wall is, north and south of it and so forth, they have allowed that because it's off of the platform area. And so all sorts of things to be said. Well, I have to move ahead. If you read in a Bible dictionary, like I have the New Bible Dictionary here in front of me, the article on it, and then the article out of Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary as well, they both give descriptions and some measurements of this. Yes?
I missed the first time. Which wall is the Wailing Wall?
The Wailing Wall is over here where I have 1590.
Right.
Down on that side is where the Wailing Wall is today. Let's see. Daniel, did you have something to say? Let's try somebody outside Cody. Give anybody else a chance before we go back to him. Okay, Cody, you got it.
Why? I mean, this is in Jerusalem, right?
Yes.
Like even today, this is
yes.
Jerusalem. How come the Israelites don't have Jerusalem?
Well, maybe you remember, we don't always put two and two together, but you might remember that Jerusalem is a divided city even today. It's broken up. and is controlled by at least three, maybe four different international groups. The whole city of Jerusalem is not under the control of the Jewish people. Even though it's their, you know, their holy city, it's also the Muslim holy city, and there's other parts of it that's under the control of another international entity. Yes?
Also, Israel right now, he had proposed, and there is a potential that's going to be turned over to the Palestinians.
Yeah, that's even being proposed. See, they're sort of in the same awkward position today as they were in New Testament times. How do we both have our city and have peace at the same time? Well, you do that by compromise. And, you know, when they're bigger than you are, we know the Israeli people, even today, if they feel like they've got the superior force or even an equal force to somebody else, there's no compromise. But if they feel like they don't have any choice but to compromise, then they will. And that's where they are, sort of, with the whole city of Jerusalem. But let's go ahead and... I'm sorry, I just can't take any more questions. I just need to push forward a little bit here. Here from, like, in the Bible Dictionary, New Bible Dictionary, and Nelson's Bible Dictionary, and many others, they give you at least some of the measurements we know of about the size of this thing. And you start realizing how large it really is. I've tried to put some of them on here. From east to west, across the bottom end here, 912 feet. They know that number exactly because both corners exist today and they can measure between them. 912 feet, that's over 300 yards wide. A modern football field for us Americans, counting the end zones, is 120 yards length, right? We're talking about something over 300 yards. We're talking about almost three football fields long just across this way. Is that big or little? And you get the idea, that's big. From this corner here up to that corner up there, 1,536 feet. Over 500 yards. That's more than four football fields long, counting end zones. Now, let's have sports fanatics in here. How wide is a football field? What is it, 75 yards? No, not 75. 60 yards? It's 55 yards, maybe. 55, 60 yards wide. Okay, 50 yards. That sounds like a good number. Let's take 50 yards. If you're trying to... Maybe just going to build your sports complex. You could just wipe off the surface of this whole thing with the Dome of the Rock and the mosque and all that stuff up there. And you're going to just lay out a bunch of football fields like some cities do with their, you know, their soccer fields for their youth soccer and so forth. And so you need to have 120 yards long and 50 yards wide. Well, if we laid out the football fields this way, you could get four fields long. And because it's 50 yards and this is 300 yards here, you get six fields across. Of course, you're not leaving any room for stands or fans or anything like that. But basically what I'm suggesting to you, you can fit 24 football fields onto the flat top surface of where the temple was. Yes?
Why is that side 1590, this one?
Because that's how big it was on that side.
Because of the the fortress?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what all the reasons were. The question is, this is not rectangular. It is four-sided. But these corners are not right angles. They're off a little bit. And that was because of the natural surface of the land, the rock underneath, what they had to work with and what were some natural barriers there. They certainly were able to make the square or rectangular, but it just did not fit what they had to do there. So they got as close as they could as they built this. We're talking about the equivalent, like I say, of 24 football fields of surface area up there. This is a gigantic place. Gigantic place. Even today. And so even a drawing like this doesn't It gives us a sense of proportion. It doesn't give us a true sense, I think, of really how large it was. And as this was built, Herod took the original stuff and expanded it out. I think the original edge of the temple before he got to it was up here somewhere. He extended this on down. He had to cut all the way down to bedrock. In some places, 50 or 60 feet below the level of the land as it is today, to lay his pilings, as we would say, his basic stuff down there, and then they built up from there. And we don't even know how large the stones are down at the base. They are able to come, like right here, there is a place somewhere where they can actually go inside, and there's a tunnel underneath some part of this. They can actually go in. And you see the huge stones that are there at this time. Here are these stones. They're 45 feet long, approximately. And 10 to 12 feet high. Yes? Time for the break? Okay. I'll finish this one. 45 feet long, about 10 to 12 feet high, and about 12 to 18 feet deep. One stone. And it's cut so smoothly that the next stone sitting on top of it is held in place without any concrete, any cement, any glue of any kind, and yet it never moves. Okay, we're talking about one stone almost as big as this room. And there's hundreds of them down there, all carefully stacked and built in place. Okay, question. Yeah, there are some differences about when you talk about the circumference. You know, the circumference is, if you start here and go walk all the way around the edge until you get back to the edge, how many feet have you covered? I've seen numbers like 3,600 feet. I've seen some numbers that were bigger. And we don't know exactly why the discrepancies. That's because practically none of this exists today. That second bell is time for our break. Let me tell you, in 1989, the Biblical Archaeology Review had a 32-page article about how the temple was built by Herod, and this was the state of the art and what they knew about that 18 years ago. They know more now, but it's still a very fascinating article. I don't know if we have a copy of it in the library or not, but I just find it amazing to read this. It talks about what kind of equipment they used. How he trained 1,000 priests to be masons or stone cutters, so that only the priests worked on the actual temple itself, the temple proper, the naos, because no one else but priests could be allowed into that area. And so he actually trained the priests to be stonemasons so they could rebuild that part of it. And it's just incredible, beyond imagination for me, how that was possible, and yet clearly it did happen. Well, let's take our break here. I'm cutting into your time.